Yes, yes. Thank you. So I wanted to think in line of the last text, which I think is a baffling text from the Gospel of Thomas, which is a Gnostic gospel, part of or ancient Gnosticism, which was part of the early Christian tradition as well. It was one of those early Jesus-following communities that went more mystical than some of the more Jewish-based Christian communities, which were sort of rooted more in the Jewish traditions and then trying to sort of reframe them in light of Jesus. So we have this other community. The Gospel of Thomas is thought to have been written around or before the other Gospels. In fact, some of the sayings in Thomas you find in a lot of the other Gospels, but the Gospel of Thomas is not a narrative. It's a collection of sayings, one of which is this one. And I thought it particularly interesting because Jesus was often, even in our more familiar canonical Gospels, was often telling stories that flipped the script. They flipped meaning on its head. Whatever you thought you knew about how you're supposed to behave, he would flip it. And there was, I believe there was a reason why he was doing it. I think the reason why he was doing it was, for one thing, because we get very conditioned in how we think. And because traditions then form around that conditioning, groups form around those traditions, and then you have whole institutions with which a number of people are excluded, right? It just happens. We form tribes, we form groups, we form institutions, and then we say who's in, and we say who's out, and that's what Jesus was confronting time and time again in his ministry, so he would flip the script. There was another thing, though, that was present in his ministry, too, that if you really thought about it, you had to kind of read between the lines, but I think that's why we see it happening with almost every institution. There's always a counter-narrative that says, yes, and. It says, yes, this is God's love. Yes, this is justice. This is how we do it. But also, there's something so unknown about where we are. There's something so humbling about who we are in relationship to our lives. And there's something so unknown and humbling about what and who and where and why God might be, that even these mystical traditions don't try to nail it down. They open it up. And so you have this text, which literally says, the bottom is flipped on the top. The outer becomes the inner, the outer, the male, the female, the female, the male. And I have to admit, and I've said this before, I think, you know, we're strongly, stridently, have always been advocates for LGBTQ inclusion and for inclusion of all people, regardless of your orientation and political orientation, and defy you not to be here regardless of your staunch stance on something, because we want to practice openness, and it's hard. It's hard to do that sometimes. So I mean that on all sides of the picture. But there's also this thing about where we are right now with trans individuals that I just want to say yes. And the reason why is because I don't fully understand. And anytime somebody comes to me with something I fully don't understand, I try to remind myself to say yes, because my conditioning will say no. Or my comfort zone will say, you know what, that's your thoughts are different from my thoughts. Your understanding of woman's right to choice is very different from my. I'm not trying to get political. I really am not. I'm just giving examples of where we find ourselves always in the midst of pushback and pushback and pushback and pushback. And how do we try to say yes? That's so challenging when stuff does not go our way. How do we say yes? I think that's what this text is about, so I titled this Saying Yes to Everything Everywhere. Because as Todd Kirk knows, one of my new favorite stories, my new favorite movies, is Everything Everywhere All at Once. How many of you seen it yet? I've been pushing this for a couple of months now. You need to go see this. Yes. But not just because of that, but because I think that's how we understand, that's how we learn to understand where we are in this time we're in, that in fact, it's not any specific time, it is all time, all the time, everywhere, all at once. And how we treat the moment is what we're invited to do as people who follow Jesus, is how we treat these moments. that we find ourselves in. Dalai Lama said the purpose of life is to be happy. John Lennon came along and said life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. Pretty much that's the nature of our reality. We're trying to be happy, things happen. And then we're just trying to deal with it. But most of us try to deal with it in controlling ways. We try to face it in as many controlling ways as we can. I love this image. We've been using this image throughout this series. This is what my son painted on his yard fence. There are those people whose hell it is to hate, those whose heaven it is to say yes with curiosity. When I told him that I was using this as sermon illustration, he said, well, that fits. That figures that you'd use my tags as sermon illustrations. But in fact, there's also another one that we didn't get up there that I wanted to quote David Richo, who says, to say yes to reality is to host eternity. To say yes to reality is to host eternity. I think that's what this text is saying to us also. How do we say yes when things don't go our way? How do we say yes in the midst of tragedy and difficulty? Throw up this next image, if you will. This is another tag that was found that's over in Europe. Tim took a picture of this, and I've been using it throughout this series. This last week, something occurred to me. Do you remember the first time you went flying, you took a flight? Do you remember the first time? Now, some of you, there may be someone in here that actually has never flown before. That's cool. There may be someone who's got some anxieties about flying, too. That's also cool. You can think of something else in just a moment when I tell you why this came to me. I was 10 years old when I took my first flight. I was flying down to Belize, where my father was. It was in 1968, thereabouts. I was maybe 10 or 11. And I remember this trip because there were several things going on in my mind. Number one, I was terrified. Never did understand how something that heavy could float. Right? That was my thinking. How does something this heavy float? And then the other thing that was terrifying to me was just the anxiety of, you know, the possibilities that might happen, the negative things that you almost always think about. Then the other thing was about the fact that I was kind of torn between two realities. My father was abusive. That's why my mom ended up divorcing him. We had a very broken family history. My father was now living in a country that used to be British Honduras at that time. It literally changed 2 or 3 years after he started living there. He was literally part of the reason why tourism got started there and diving got started there several decades ago. He had a tiny little hotel, not even hardly a hotel. It had 6 rooms and a thatch hut, and the village was only about 200 people. Now San Pedro is enormous, and it's one of the first stops for tours, for cruises. There was this excitement about going to this mysterious place at the same time that I would be in an isolated place with the guy who was not very nice to me. But the reason I was supposedly going was for relationship, right? Now, that whole narrative has taken a long time to reframe, you can imagine. And I imagine many of you have similar narratives that you've learned or that you're working on even now reframing. Understanding in light of eternity, if you will. But what caught me was the first time I got up, it was a cloudy day, it was a rainy day, and I looked at the clouds above as we were taking off, and I thought, we're going to have to fly for miles and miles before we can get out from under these clouds. That's what I thought. And I kept wondering about that as we immediately began to take off and pass through the clouds. And it struck me as an amazement, something I had never considered before, that it really just caught me off guard, and now I was just watching as we moved through this cloudiness. Then I got to wondering, how does the pilot know where he's going? How can you even drive? My mom complained every time there was a heavy fog. And then we, of course, cleared it. We were above it, and in short time, we were far above it. And I was looking at those towers of clouds that you see around, reflecting all shades of darkness and brilliance and light. And the strange thought occurred to me that this sun has been here the whole time. Even while I was underneath the clouds, the light was always shining, never stopped. And then it occurred to me, wait a minute, the clouds are still there, and those folks down there are still experiencing the darkness under the cloud, even though the sun is shining. And that image has been on the back of my mind for years and years as I've tried to understand this reality that we find ourselves in, that we were constantly balancing this reality that the darkness and the light exist at the same time. And so what we're invited to do, the next slide, and I just put this up here to make it visual, is what we're always invited to do is to find ways to nurture this moment that we're in. Every time we find ourselves getting caught in the past, getting anxious about the future, we've redefined the present. Because as Einstein had said, the distinctions between past, present, and future are nothing but an illusion. It's just an illusion. But it's a stubborn one, isn't it? It's hard to shake that illusion. It's hard to say yes to the stuff that we've become accustomed to making us miserable when it does, or making us happy when it does. We live in this transactional relationship with life, with creation, when in fact, those early mystics were trying to tell us that when you get to that place, when you can see that it's all the same, all the time, everywhere, all at once, and that it's all rooted in the love and creative presence of what is sacred. And when you get there, oh, now time's eternal. But it takes practice. So we talk about practice. Because if you don't intentionally practice being more mindful, giving yourself more grace, reminding yourself that you are in the midst of this darkness while the light still shines, and sometimes reminding yourself when the light is really shining, you don't have to go too dark, but remind yourself, it's still dark. We have to get in that place where we can live with equanimity and with a calmness that says yes. So the band, I'm going to invite them to come on because they have this last song that they're going to share with us. But I wanted to share this final image. This next quote is something that I remember vividly as part of that childhood when I was trying to piece together my family, my family's history, my Irish grandmother's immigration from Ireland, when she brought my father over as an infant, all of those narratives that have fed who I am, and now little Orban Fox, my wife hates the name. My daughter-in-law loves the name because guess who Orban was? The oldest person she remembers as a child, right? You see how it works? So Linda will come along, she'll figure it out. And if she doesn't, we'll all be graceful because we realize the stories are always much larger than us and every single moment's waiting for some redemptive opportunity if we but start to nurture those moments. And this is how we nurture it. We realize that it's just a stream we're fishing in. When my uncle would take me fishing and camping, he would always remind me as we would camp, there's always bears out there. And I'd say, well, then shouldn't we be scared? And he said, well, I suppose if you run into one, if you just pay attention and listen, you'll figure out how to live with the bears. Usually that works. It's pretty infrequently that a bear eats somebody. But then just to make sure that I was on my toes, he said, but it can happen. And then he'd go fishing and he would kiss the minnows before he would throw it in. He always would kiss the minnows and throw it in for his bait. And then I laughed at him one time because I said, you know, Uncle Mac, I've realized that you catch more fish when you don't kiss than when you do kiss the minnows. And he would say, well, maybe it's not as much of a superstition as I thought. And that's true. Superstitions are what they are because they kind of anchor us. The plane is going to crash. So we do all sorts of things to prevent that happening in our minds. I'm going to lose something here that I really love. So we do all sorts of things to cling as tightly as we can. I'm not getting the thing that I want. So we cling as tightly as we can, and we create all sorts of rituals around why that's bad or why we really need to work harder. But the reality is we're all just fishing in the stream. And we're more likely to catch the fish when we're less anchored to the superstition. Does that make sense? That may be a little confusing. Here's a good practice. Always stay open to your moments. Always remind yourself the light's shining even when it's dark. And when it's light shining, it's still dark. It's all the same. It's all the same all the time, everywhere. But at the root of that, when we can tap into the root of that, we tap into the creative love of God, or call it the creative love of life, or call it the creative love of evolving creativity, but we tap into something that reminds us we're part of everything all at once, all at the same time. And then my uncle's final words when we would pack up camp, always leave the place better than you found it. Amen.